The following program is brought to you by Podcast One. Recorded live backstage, this is Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Here's this week's guest host, Soledad O'Brien.
I'm Soledad O'Brien, and today on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted, we welcome Charlize Theron and Kwaku Mandela.
Hey, everyone. Thank you all for being here to celebrate my grandfather's legacy. I'm really pleased and excited to be able to kick off the 100th celebration with my dear friend Charlize and all of her amazing team at CTAOP. And Soledad O'Brien. I think, as we all know, 2017 was a year of a lot of division. And my hope is that 2018 will not only be the year of woman, but also be the year of love, where we realize that connection is really the solution. It's something that my grandfather talked about a lot, the importance of realizing what we have in common with each other rather than what makes us different. And so I'm excited this year because together with a young man that you'll meet a little bit later, Patrick Finnegan and Zendaya, we've created a program of events called Nelson Mandela 100 Conversations. And it's all about bridging my grandfather's legacy to the next generation by creating two-way conversations between 100 ambassadors and them. And so we're going to go to 100 cities around the world and have conversations very similar to this, where we talk about what my grandfather's legacy represents in a modern day and age, but we also ask the audience to tell us how they see the world. And I think it's so important in this day and age where young people are really looking for inspiration and looking for their value and purpose that we can share a platform with them where their voices can be heard. So with that said, I'd like to thank Soledad for offering to moderate this conversation, and I'll kick it over to you.
Perfect, thank you. And welcome, everybody. I'm going to be the moderator for the evening. We're going to be talking for just about 30 minutes, and then I'm going to open our conversation up to your questions. So let's get right to it. You guys know each other personally, your friends, and then, of course...
Sometimes.
Depends on the day.
Can you pronounce her last name right? Just asking.
Get off.
Well, apparently, to be my friend, you should not be able to pronounce it.
That's true.
And also, you work together at CTAOP.
We have.
Tell me a little bit about how Nelson Mandela's legacy has personally affected each of you. And Charlize, why don't you start, and then we'll talk about your perspective on your grandfather. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, you know, yes, I'm a South African, but I don't think that my inspiration, the inspiration that I got from him and the connection that I got from him and what he means to me almost has anything to do with that. I think that he's such an international figure when it comes to compassion and speaking empathy. And I think everything, all of his values, all of the values that he embodies is something that crosses all borders, you know. And I think that's what's so great about what's happening here. And I really want to thank you for asking me to be a part of this. It's so great to be able to talk about such an incredible man. But yeah, I mean, for me, there's something, I always say that Nelson Mandela to me is the ultimate humanist. You know, there is something about his capability in not having any resentment for all the wrongs that were done to him for so many years growing up in a country with so much turmoil and oppression, to have somebody kind of step out of that mud and be as insightful and inspiring as he was and unifying. I mean, South Africa at the time of his release was on the brink of civil war. And this was a guy who had absolutely no resentment. As a matter of fact, he famously said, resentment is like drinking poison, thinking you're going to kill your enemy, and you're not going to kill your enemy. And that was something that was very important to him. And one of the first times that I ever met him, I asked him about that. I think, you know, maybe my obsession with human nature and just the condition of our humanity and that we do struggle with those moments, and of course we can completely empathize if that was the case. I mean, for what was taken from him, he never ever spoke with any hatred, with any resentment, there was just such an honesty and pathos with how he looked at the circumstances of South Africa in particular, but just humanity across the world, that is, I find it very hard to not be inspired. I want to meet somebody who has not been inspired by him. I think he's a, for me, he is the ultimate embodiment of modern, the spirit of modern South Africa today.
Which is an interesting juxtaposition, because I know these 100 conversations have come about because you worry about losing young people's connection to Nelson Mandela's legacy. Talk about your own connection to your grandfather.
You know, I only got to meet my grandfather when I was 4.5 years old, and I had heard about him for a number of years, but it was only when we went to Victor Verster and he was still under house arrest. And I remember walking into this house and just feeling this kind of warmth as this old man came and said, are these my grandkids? And then he offered for us to watch cartoons on television. And he just had this way of kind of making you feel like you were the only person in the room. And he was extremely humble. And I think, you know, as far as kind of politicians go, he never allowed himself to be trapped in this bubble. He was highly unpredictable. So I remember we were traveling from his office in Pretoria one day, and he randomly said to the security that he wanted to go to the closest high school. And they were like, what do you mean? He's like, I want you to find the closest high school. I want to go there. And they found a high school, and he went there, you know, basically surprised the teachers and surprised the kids. And it was his way of just staying in touch with people on a day-to-day basis and not getting kind of trapped, I think, often, like we all can, within this kind of bubble or safety of comfortability of our everyday lives. And so that's something that always stuck with me, is try and push yourself outside of the kind of the boundaries that you feel comfortable in.
What's your goal with the 100 conversations? You mentioned a little bit about it, but it's focused only on young people?
Its focus is only on young people. And I think that's because I've come to realize, you know, traveling around the world, that a lot of young people know the name Nelson Mandela, but don't necessarily know what he represents and stands for. And yet they probably have, I think, the biggest potential to really impact our world, because the way young people currently interact with their societies and are looking at how they can have an impact is so vast. And so for me, it was really important to find a platform where, you know, I could encourage them to look at my grandfather's legacy and then realize the impact that they can have to take that out into the world.
Charlize, when did you start your foundation, CTAOP?
We launched in 2007. It took a couple of years to really brainstorm and solidify what we wanted our mandate to be. You know, when I started CTOP, it was really tied to my love for my home country of South Africa. And at that time, one of the biggest challenges that we faced, there was many, but was the highest HIV rates in the world. And unfortunately, we still have those numbers. We have noticed in the last decade that demographically those numbers are dropping. Infection rates are dropping, but they are not dropping with adolescents. And so CTOP was really, it really came from meeting incredible people who were working for grassroots organizations in South Africa within the communities that were the hardest hit, where infection rates were higher than 50%. And they just didn't have the tools or the funding or access to what they needed to actually continue the work that they were doing. So we founded CTOP to be a support system for, right now we support 8 grassroots organizations. We just celebrated our 10-year anniversary, and we've serviced over 300,000 individuals with healthcare and AIDS prevention information. And very much like Kwaku just said, you know, it was for us, and even early on, before the numbers were what they are today with adolescents and new infection rates, there was definitely a worry because of the AIDS epidemic, that an entire generation was practically wiped out, that we were going to have a lot of young kids growing up in a place where it was dangerous to make one mistake. And they really didn't have access to the tools or the resources that they needed to just have basic information about safety, or to take ownership of their lives and the choices that they made. And so, I think in many ways we were always very aware of Nelson Mandela when we talked about the work that we wanted to do within CTOP, because Nelson Mandela was really one of the first people who talked about the power of the youth and was such a true believer that they were the game changers, they were the actors of change. And, not to quote him all night, but one of my favorite things that he...
You can, because this is what we're here
this
for.
This is the occasion for it. All right, then I'll go. But he, he said, young people, when they're giving the capability, will, and when they're aroused, will bring down the towers of oppression and raise the banners of freedom. And I think he used to always talk about how being around kids and being around young people for him was like, his battery was being charged. And he had a great capacity to respect and listen to the youth, and I think it was because he knew the importance of their leadership, not only just in South Africa, but to the world. And so we really embraced that idea with CTOP, knowing that, yes, we get to do all this great work, but ultimately it is to benefit the youth of this country in order to continue the greatness of the legacy of South Africa and to fix some of the problems that we have. And I personally don't think the solution of any of those problems are lying within any of our generation, sorry. But it lies with the youth, and they need to have a seat at the table. We need to have them be part of the decision-making process of telling us what they need.
There are so many serious issues facing the world today, facing this country today. Tolerance, hatred, overt racism that seems to be on the rise, anti-Semitism. How do you think about what Mandela would say around building consensus when there are two poles and sometimes people don't even think the other person's human, right? I mean, this was to some degree the arc of his struggle. It seems like a massive obstacle, and yet he was able to bridge it. Are we able to bridge that?
I think if you look at our history, we are. But we need to learn from those past mistakes. And I think, as you said, with apartheid in South Africa, it was essentially a system that was set up to dehumanize anyone that was of color. And the way they were able to overcome it was to build this mass movement that didn't just take place in South Africa. It kind of reverberated around the world. And so you had millions and millions of young students who, for instance, in the UK, divested their bank accounts from Barclays Bank, which was the biggest funder of the apartheid government. And that forced Barclays to pull out of South Africa. You had strategically, young students in America who were putting pressure on their universities to also divest from companies that were invested in South Africa. So it was really smart thinking led by youthful energy. And I think, again, we're at this kind of crossroads where we're seeing hate kind of flare itself up again. I think we're looking for that new leadership to kind of pick up this mantle, and I strongly believe it's going to come from the youth.
Do you see an ability to bridge those gaps between people who at this moment sometimes feel like there's nothing that they have in common?
Well, I think history has shown us that things work out better when we work together. And I think very much in the vein of what Kwaku just said, we have to be able to look at history and learn from those mistakes. And South Africa is a great example of that. And I think I'm still positive about everything because, ultimately what one man ended up doing in South Africa, unifying so many different cultures, so many different races, and in many ways, it was far more extreme than what is happening here right now, but that doesn't mean that that can't happen here. That gives me hope. It's really up to us allowing young voices to kind of step in and take the leadership that they want to take. You know, I look at what happened with gay marriage rights. And that was really the youth standing up. They were the loudest about not being happy about that, and they were also the biggest supporters of it, and they changed that. And I think that we have to look at those circumstances and realize that they kind of are interconnected with everything. They're interconnected with our politics, with human rights, and the more we allow young people to kind of have that voice, I really believe the better we're off. They are not stuck in... You know, there's something beautiful about a young mind. There's no preconceived notions of how things were or should be. They know that this is how it should be. And I think, in a way, that slight bit of whatever you want to call it, naivete or innocence or whatever, or...
sense of adventure.
Yeah. It's something to really aspire to, because they really are the ones that are making things happen.
When you look at the data, they don't vote.
When in this country. Yeah.
When you... and figuring out how to get them engaged, right? As opposed to... I mean, and I would see this a lot in the young people we would interview in this, you know, political show I host. And they would have a lot of, you know, deep, enthusiastic talk, a lot about, actually fairly knowledgeable about the issues, but the getting them to go and do something versus just talking about how they felt about it seemed problematic. And the data bears out that in this country they don't vote. How do you motivate someone young to become engaged, especially at a time when I think there's a ton of disillusionment about politics, about politicians, about an ability to affect real change?
I think storytelling plays a huge role, particularly in inspiring, you know, young people.
How
if you
mean?
Look at Obama, it's probably one of the greatest kind of American stories that we've seen in recent history, and it inspired a number of young people to come out and not only vote, but actively participate in getting their communities and getting their friends and getting their families to vote. And we've seen it with, you know, something like the ALS Challenge. Young people around this country actively got out and participated in that. They get out every day and post on Instagram and post on Facebook. So they need to feel inspired to do something. And I think for far too long, you know, politics hasn't really been able to do that. And I think the importance is kind of figuring out how we can start to create these stories that inspire, you know, the youth to want to engage, to want to go and vote.
Right now, there's a gubernatorial election in Kansas. And I think there's four or five young people who are running for governor, or one for secretary of state, who are teenagers, 17, 16, I think maybe an 18-year-old.
Go, Lucy.
Yeah. But I wish I could say that there is a great movement in the government to encourage those young people to use their voice and their power. But actually, the movement is to shut them down and figure out how to close a loophole that's allowed them all to run.
Yeah, let's find more loopholes. I mean, honestly, I think that we have to be careful to not become a society where we value what somebody brings to the table when it comes to country, society, as a tribe. We have a tendency to belittle when it comes to the youth. And, you know, going back to your question before, I think this year politicians have definitely, and if they haven't, then I give up, I don't know. But it would be pretty hard to not see that inspiration has to come from them as well. We have a lot of grassroots communities within our country that worked really hard with the youth. And there was a lot of disenfranchised. I get what happened, but I feel like politicians have to take more ownership in understanding the value that their vote brings and how much they should be valued to what they say and need and want. You know, just to bring it back to why we're here tonight, Nelson Mandela was one of the best listeners that you could ever be around. He had this capability to sit in a room and really listen and to make you feel like you were the only person there, but not by talking, by listening. And I don't think we do enough of that, especially in this country, but in the world. And it's time for us to kind of change our thinking to, oh, well, you're 22 or you're 23. What can you bring to this? Like, you haven't lived life. You don't know. We have to start living in a world where we see the value of what a young person brings to the table. And I think it will change the way voting stands in this country.
You had mentioned earlier that the great narrative of Nelson Mandela was this forgiveness that was almost impossible,
yeah.
Right? I mean, impossible yeah. to wrap your head around.
It made me feel really bad about myself.
Forgiving your jailer, mm-hmm. forgiving your warden, forgiving the person who had intentions to kill you, right? I mean, those were things that he did that he recognized the only way to bring healing, right, was that it had to be done. And I look today in this country, and you look at, let's pull it up, any sort of thing that people are arguing over vociferously, like Me Too, right? Do you see an area where we're ready to have conversations about coming together, or are we always going to be arguing?
Well, yeah, I feel it too. I feel that things are kind of, the temperature has risen to a degree where it's people, I find generally in any kind of social or anywhere there is a conversation, a debate happening about politics or the issues that we're facing today, where you definitely get a very quick, I mean, people are, there's, I think people are heated. People have a lot of passion about this. People have a lot of anger.
I was going to use the word hostility.
Hostility.
You say passion.
Anger.
I say hostility.
And I think that you know, when this election happened and everybody was in this kind of state of like, how did this happen? You have to kind of be able to look and say, where was the conversation that was being held on both sides? And I think we have now gone, the pendulum is swinging so far to the left and so far to the right that we don't see what is actually what we have in common anymore. And so all we do is argue about how the other side is wrong instead of coming to the middle and seeing like, well, what is the thing that we do have in common and how we can work together? And until that happens, we'll just be in this war. You know, we can fight and say the other guy is as bad as we think they are, and that's fine. We have that freedom. How great. But until we can actually hear what the other side has to say and come into this and find this sweet spot where we can actually work with each other, nothing is going to change.
How do we do that? I mean, again, we would all say Nelson Mandela, who was able to do that, who modeled that, was almost inhuman in his ability to do.
Well, we need leadership. We need new, fresh leadership that can think the way Mandela did. You know, we obviously don't have that, and it's not just in this country. It's all over the world. We need fresh blood. That is why I feel like it is our duty to support the youth in order to be those leaders that we need, so that they can step in and start communicating in a way that is different than what we have been hearing for the last however many years.
I think it's also about understanding, and I think that's one of the things my grandfather, you know, took time to really understand, you know, what the Afrikaans people were like, what these communities had gone through, and the fact that, you know, they themselves had deep fears, and that, you know, informed the way they treated people of color in South Africa. And I think that made it a lot easier for him to understand, you know, that they have flaws, but we also, you know, as African people have flaws. And it's only when you can actually be open about your flaws, I think, realistically, that you can hope to meet someone in the middle ground where you can have an honest conversation with them.
You had mentioned that you think a good strategy is storytelling. How do you figure out how to navigate that so you're not just preaching to the choir, that everyone in the room is everyone who's already on your side, and you're not ignoring those people who you have to have those uncomfortable conversations that we all like to avoid?
I think it goes back to Charlize's point about listening and not always having to be the one that's kind of telling someone your views or your perspective, but, you know, hearing something that may not be something you grew up with or something that you understand. It may be contrary to your value system or belief, but being able to at least hear it and observe that and take that in is vitally important.
Nelson Mandela, I think, represented a voice for basic fairness, for things that just seem like obviously this thing is unfair and how do we fix it? You've been very open, Charlize, about your efforts for equal pay, making headlines when you asked for that. You've talked a lot about embracing feminism at a time when it's almost like it's a dirty word. I mean, I've been on panels with young women who are embarrassed to say that they're feminists. It's, I find it so strange. Are you surprised at how that sort of request for basic fairness is headline making?
Well, it's interesting that you were saying that you don't understand when, you know, girls or women say that, you know, they're ashamed to say they're feminist. And I had a moment today where I realized that when I was in my 20s, when my early, I'm 43.
You're 42.
Oh, sorry, I'm 42. I feel so much younger. I realized that when I was interviewed and journalists would ask me, are you a feminist? And, you know, it wasn't until this movement happened that I had to actually go back and think about it. And I remember always saying, well, you know, being a feminist means a different thing to everybody. And I would kind of apologize for it. And I had to sit with myself today and kind of think, why was that? Like, why could I not just say, yes, I'm a feminist? And however you take that as you own that. But I'm a feminist, and I think it's good when you can realize, you know, I am in a position, I am so incredibly grateful to be in this position where I could put my foot down and say, I want equal pay to my male co-star, who I had built another movie with, we were doing a sequel, we had done it together, why not? And I was, you know, what was interesting about that event was that I had a studio that literally said, all right. And I realized, I was like, oh, like, we just need to say this. Like, we actually just need to, like, not be so polite about it and just, like, say what we want, knowing that that is not the case for the majority of women who are working in my industry. And so whenever, you know, I talk about that moment, I feel like, if I can shed light on the reality of what it's like to be the majority of actresses working who are not getting even closely paid to what their male counterparts, co-stars, are being paid, who if they went and said to a studio or to a producer, I want equal pay, they would get fired. They would get replaced in a heartbeat. And that's just the reality of that. And so I realized that for me, the conversation has become about those women. You know, I felt lucky and, no, I didn't feel lucky. I deserved that, and I asked for it. And I now want to get women who are maybe in my position to empower, not empower the women, but to get our industry, and not just within our industry, something that is, you know, bleeding into all walks. This is not just isolated to Hollywood, but we have to find and you know, the movement that's happening right now is incredibly supportive towards that on a financial matter, where women are being allowed to take ownership of their voice and say what they need more, and then also financially being supported in order to do that. Because if you don't have that, saying that you want something that you're not going to get and then get fired and having to feed your kids are two very, very different things. And so I think we're in an interesting place right now where we can actually support women to actually see something through where their families are not going to be hurt by it. And I think hopefully we're encouraging an environment in workplaces where this is not isolated cases anymore, but where we're changing just how people go about business. I don't even know if I answered your question.
You did. You very much answered the question.
But today I'm proud to say that I am a fucking feminist.
Kweku, at a time when foreign aid is less popular than ever, and in fact, even the conversations around foreign aid are sort of like, well, why would you want to send money over there anyway? And really, more conversations are about walls and borders and how high it should be and how you keep people out. How do you have this conversation, 100 conversations that seem at the heart of them, to try to connect people wherever they are around the globe?
I think, again, you're, you know, hoping to outweigh the negative with positive. And I think, you know, youth interact in this day and age using technology already. So it's, why can't we get them in a room and have them kind of share their stories, have them share their perspective on the world? I think it's a challenge to the status quo that we've seen for the past year. And my hope is that it resonates and it builds on something that, again, will bring people closer together.
This is a quote from your grandfather. His generation, he said, traversed a century that was characterized by conflict, bloodshed, hatred, and intolerance, a century which tried but could not fully resolve the problems of disparity between the rich and poor, between developing and developed countries. Are we on a path to resolving that great gap?
I think we've come a long way. You know, as both me and Charlize have said, if you look at the HIV and AIDS epidemic in South Africa, and, you know, the fact that millions of families were affected by this and millions of people's lives were lost, we're now at a place where realistically in the next 15 to 20 years, we could be the generation that ends AIDS. And that's come through programs that Charlize Theron's, you know, foundation has been able to administer. It's also come through a general education of youth learning more about the need to be informed about their status and to also partake in letting the rest of their friends and community know about these issues. And so, yes, I do believe that we can overcome a lot of the major social issues that we deal with. But again, it comes down to leadership. And I think we need to look, you know, elsewhere. And I particularly believe that the youth in this day and age can be those leaders for us.
Do you worry that your grandfather's legacy is important and historic, but losing its relevancy for young people? You know, in Cuba, when people talk about Castro before he died, they really talked about him like an irrelevant grandfather. Do you worry that, you know, conversations for young people just become, I know he's important, he's in the history books, but I don't have a sense of what he mattered physically.
I think so, but I also believe there's a lot of really intelligent, you know, just really deep young kids that do understand that, and they understand that from their own kind of spiritual level. And that's what's impressed me. I think, you know, culture's always going to change. And, you know, young people often are going to follow the trends that their peers are following. That doesn't mean that they're also not going to feel a sense of, one, you know, passion and a sense of responsibility to go out there and represent their communities. And I think by doing that, they'll always keep a bit of, you know, who my grandfather was, because in essence, he was this rural, you know, country boy from the Eastern Cape who, throughout the circumstances of his life and what he had to go up against, became, you know, the president of South Africa and ultimately became this kind of moral figure to people around the world.
Your grandfather also was brutally honest. I mean, even as he was forgiving people, he wasn't sort of whitewashing and forgetting what had happened. He was very clear. I mean, his book, Long Walk to Freedom, was very clear in the detail of his experiences. There's news now that in Poland, it is now a crime to say that Poland was complicit in the Holocaust. How do you possibly think globally about not allowing people to talk truthfully about historical events and still think about making sure that genocide or a Holocaust or apartheid doesn't happen ever again?
It's so dangerous. It's just so dangerous to not value the truth and honor the truth of our history. And in many ways, you know, I think it's the greatest learning tool for us as human beings. We learn, this has been proven scientifically through example. And what a better example than history to be able to look back and talk honestly about things that have happened and how not to repeat them. And I don't know the value that you get out of not acknowledging mistakes. I think we teach our children, and Nelson Mandela, again, very famous quote, you know, it's not about falling, it's not about the number of times you fall down, it's about did you get up afterwards? And we teach our children that. I taught my kids that this morning at basketball practice. How do you not value what history gives us in that lesson and learn from that and be a better nation? I don't know how that could ever work. You know, I think the biggest thing that came out of South Africa that I have always, no matter where I've gone in the world, that people hold in such high regard is the truth and reconcile commit. It's a concept that is something that people just get. It is the understanding that you have to be able to acknowledge the mistake and own the mistake. And yet again, these are things that we teach our kids every single day. I think it's part of the fabric of a healthy society. We have to value it. We have to fight for it. I think, you know, it's very dangerous what could happen in Poland.
Before I open up to questions, my last question for you guys. What's the one message? You have two children, 2 and 6.
Yeah.
What's the message that you would say if you had to boil down, and you've already had a number of quotes, but I'm going to make it boil it down
to
What would be the one thing that you would want to impart to future generations? But I'm going to make you just pick one about the essence of who Nelson Mandela was as we kick off these 100 conversations.
If you believe in something, then you can truly make it happen. You can overcome, you know, the largest obstacles, whether it's oppression or racism or going up against the system.
Oh, that's a good one. Bastard. look, for me, the first time I ever met him, the thing that for me was so overwhelming about him was what I talked about earlier, his capability of forgiving and his compassion. His compassion to me, it's awe-inspiring. And, you know, I was lucky enough that when my first baby was hitting all her milestones, we were in South Africa a lot. And we would take that, you know, the freeway coming into Cape Town and the Nelson Mandela, that building with Nelson Mandela's face on it. And, you know, one of the first sentences she ever put together was, Nelson Mandela on the building. And, you know, no concept of anything, but there was a sense of pride just because of my knowledge and history of who he is, and not as a South African, but as a human, and that I want those values instilled in my children. I look at somebody like him, and I think, God, I hope he doesn't become like all of the great teachers of our past, Martin Luther King. I mean, all of them that you can name, that they don't just become school projects that are talked about for a week, but that we as parents take ownership of really keeping their legacies alive. I bought her a clock, a Nelson Mandela face clock. And at night, she says goodnight to Nelson Mandela. But her first, when she was little in preschool, one of her first, they're like, bring something in, you know, about your history of your family or something. And I said, well, what do you want to take in? Thinking she'd want to take, you know, biscuits or something in. And she's like, I want to take my clock in. It's like this little 2-year-old walking into preschool with her Nelson Mandela. I mean, she didn't know what to say, but she's like, but I feel that it starts somewhere, and then we have to continue it, and we can't just kind of rely, you know, on the school project being the thing. We have to, as parents, I think, teach our children to have the right values, and not. Is not just, you know, the common things that we think about, but the bigger things about humanity, the bigger things about our interconnectedness of, as human beings, and how we are all interconnected, and how, you know, I'm going to give one more quote. I was gonna hold back. I was like, don't do it, but I'm gonna do it.
Do it.
I think it was in his book, and I don't want to be wrong, but I think in his book he wrote about how, and it's not a quote, but it's something about how, you know, that hate, we're not born with hate. We have to be taught to hate. And, you know, what you realize is that love is the most natural thing that comes to our heart. And if you can be taught hate, you can learn to love. And I think that that has always kind of stayed with me in raising my children and kind of creating my own tribe around me, the people that I want to be around with, and people who are very, you know, active in wanting to change through movements and through whatever it is, who are actively trying to change the status quo for what it is right now. And for me, he's just so encapsulates that. I just, I feel really blessed and lucky that I got to meet him and spend a little time with him. He's an incredible, I talk about him like he's still here. He's an incredible man.
Let's open it up for questions. And if you guys should just raise the lights for me just a tiny bit. Perfect. If you have a question, will you raise your hand? And I think the audio is good enough that you'll be able to just yell it out. Introduce yourself. Why don't you stand up, sir? Introduce yourself and then ask your question. Oh, and the only rule I have in Q&A is there has to be a question in your question. Or I'll invite you to sit down.
Hi, my name is Jordan Rafe. We talked a little bit about the Me Too movement. And I wonder, do you think we'll see real institutional change coming out of this? You know, I mean, are we going to see things put in place where women can complain and be respected and get an answer.
And not be called a bitch.
Yeah, right. Or are we going to see like a lot of hot air like we was seeing? Yeah. Not a lot of hot air, but is this just going to be noise or is it going to be change?
Well, I mean, look, I don't have a crystal ball, so I don't hold me to this, but I actually really believe that nothing like this has ever happened. And so the amount of traction and the amount of women who are being empowered by other women to step forward and to actually speak their truth. I know that in my life, I've never seen anything like that. And there were always these kind of specks of moments in my 25 years of being in this business where little things would happen. One person would say something and it would kind of like cause a stir and it would literally last 3 months. But, you know, for those 3 months, that's all everybody wanted to talk about. But then it just went away. I've never seen anything at this capacity where this many people have inspired other people to finally just say, this is the truth, and I'm taking ownership of this. And I think success and long-term success for us as women are going to come out of the support that we give each other, out of not stopping this momentum. And I think that This is a rock rolling down a mountain really fast, and I'm quite enjoying watching it. Oh,
we have another question.
All right.
Go ahead, sir. Why don't you stand up?
Hello, my name is Keith. If your grandfather spent a weekend with Donald Trump, what do you think they would talk about, and what do you think would be the outcome of that conversation?
I think they'd probably talk about their backgrounds, you know, probably their kind of love or shared love for food. I don't know. I think my granddad would probably, you know, probably listen a lot more than talk in that scenario.
He'll laugh a lot. Yeah.
And I'm not sure what they'd have in common, to be frank with you. But my hope is that at the end of it, they'd learn more about each other. I think that's the most important thing when any humans interact, is if you can walk away from that experience feeling like you better understand, even if you don't necessarily agree with that person. So that would be my hope. out of Trump meeting my grandfather, which I think it actually did happen once.
Oh, they met?
Yeah, I think they met in New York with the Clintons.
And did you hear anything about it?
I think the experience was, or at least Trump really liked meeting him.
Of course,
yeah. I think he boosted, definitely boosted his ego, for sure. Yeah.
Right back there. Go ahead.
What do you guys think are the most important things, or at least the most powerful tools that we can use to encourage or ensure that people take the emotions that they're feeling towards everything that's happening into action and make sure that it doesn't get lost to the complacency of, like, the digital platform?
Well, do you want to go? I want to talk over you.
No, I mean, I'll say really quickly, I think speak up and be heard. And that's what, you know, the kind of Me Too movement's been about in any great movement, whether it's the civil rights or the anti-apartheid movement, is really having your voice be heard and not allowing yourself to be kind of pushed down or pushed to the side.
Can I add on to that question, though? I feel that people spend an hour on Twitter and feel like hashtag whatever it is, and then they've been heard, right? And you're talking about mobilizing all of that into...
Yeah, but I will say there is a lot of that. But there is also the reverse of that. There are people who are actually, look, we have a great tool to our disposal, and we've never, you know, most of my life, I didn't have that tool. And not that I'm using it to my, like, I probably should go to night school and learn how to use it better. But our younger generation really knows how to use social media in a way where it really can have impact. The problem is that a lot of them choose not to actually have it, let it have impact, and instead decides to tell us that they're buying a Starbucks coffee. And the thing that does happen from a hashtag, we have a hashtag. We have a agenda-ended hashtag, so not that I'm trying to defend it, but I think that when you can create a platform where people, like-minded people who want to be involved in the thing that you're interested in, have a space where they can actually come and inform themselves and then meet other people, it causes, the result of that is people coming together, and revolutions are started that way. And in many ways, that is why we created hashtag Agenda. And, you know, finding a space where we can get youth to be empowered, to know their status, to get together, to understand the things that they need and ask for it. And really what Kwaku said earlier, to allow them to have the tools in order to take ownership of what is becoming their problem. You know, they are the hardest hit by HIV. And so let them be, they are the ones that can solve this. We just have never allowed them to do that. So giving them that space has really empowered and started a movement. And so I do think that there's power in social media. I just don't think that we necessarily really truly understand how to use that as a positive. That's the thing that irks me the most. You know, it's just the majority of it is just, anyway, I'm not going to get into it.
Back here. Go ahead.
As a follow-up and to both of your questions, if this were 2019 and you've had your 100 conversations and been in 100 different cities, I'm curious sort of what are the goals for each of you, not that you're going to be on all of them, but what would you reflect back on that was an accomplishment after those conversations? What does success look like?
I think for me is it would reaffirm my belief that, again, leadership is going to come from the youth. I've always kind of had this theory around politicians that every politician starts off with the greatest of ambitions to change their, you know, potentially their community, then their nation, and maybe the world. And as they kind of go on in politics, the more and more they do it, they realize that they need power and they need resources and they need a constituency. And so they start to compromise themselves. And once you open those floodgates, it's very hard to close them again. And so the longer you're in politics, the more jaded you tend to be. And that's why, again, I feel, you know, the youth really have so much to kind of give us because they're not jaded. They have this energy. They have this belief. And they see the world for exactly what it is, not what they might want it to be. And so my hope would be, again, that we're able to identify that talent, because I think we really need it.
Back here. Go ahead, sir.
It's sort of a follow-up to the follow-up. With your focus on the youth, is there anybody who is right now in a position of power, influence, that sort of, well, nobody lives up fully to Nelson Mandela's, obviously, almost superhuman stature. Is there anybody that gives you hope right now, who is in positions of power right now, who says, you know what, more people like that is really, we can sort of hang our hats on? Or is it, do we have to throw everybody who is 43 and up out of the room and it has to be back to the youth?
I think there are leaders that have stepped up. You know, the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, has definitely stepped up.
Well, he's amped up his sock game, for sure.
That's I think, you know, in France, we just saw the French President, Macron, commit to the new global replenishment for education. And kind of France, I think, put more than 50% of that amount in. So you're seeing certain leaders step up. But generally, I still feel, you know, that there needs to be that kind of next wave of leadership. What we saw, I think, you know, in the 90s, when you had Nelson Mandela, you had Tony Blair, you had Bill Clinton. And I'm hoping that that's going to come from the youth.
I'm going to go and educate myself on Lucy when I get back. I'm probably going to say her right now, but I have to go and educate myself first. But I just love that this 17-year-old girl is running for Secretary of State. I just think it's amazing. So bless you.
We have time for one last question. I'll bring it to you back there. Why don't you stand up? We'll bring you a mic.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm Glenda. I want to say thank you immensely because I know the sacrifice your family went through with your grandfather. I appreciate that. I want to say, I don't know if this is a question, but I want to tell you.
No, see me shifting in my seat.
I think that when they ask who are the new leaders, I don't know how we're missing. This is, how do we bridge this? Because I see plenty new leaders coming out. I don't know how we miss Kaepernick. He's a leader. I don't know how we miss that. Common. These people are very active, and they put their money where their mouths are, and they make differences. We can't just throw them to the wayside. These people are making differences.
So I'll ask the question out of that. Thank you for teeing it up. Do you think the next round of leaders is young? Is it the Lucys, the 16, the 17-year-old? Is it, I mean, to some degree, some of the challenges in the United States is the structure of politics makes you run and collect money all the time.
Sure.
Makes you glom onto a donor.
Yeah, it's a
ASAP,
bigger question.
Right?
Do
I mean, it's
that?
A
yes.
Structural issue.
Yeah.
So where do you see the next, you know, people ask that question, where is the next Martin Luther King? Is it five people? Is it one person? How do you see that?
Well,
looking?
Listen, if they came around that easily, we wouldn't have Martin Luther King's and Nelson Mandela's. So we know that that is a gem to be found. But I do think that, you know, I think that America, for a second we'll talk about America, but, you know, this is something that kind of happens everywhere at a certain point. I think that we, you know, I say we because I'm an American now too, and I've lived here for a long time, so I feel like I can talk like that. A lot of people don't think so, but screw you. But I think that we have lived a little bit, how do I say this? You know, cushioned. Like, America is, you know, the place where the great dream is, and I chased it myself coming from South Africa. And I would sometimes talk to, you know, when I was in my earlier 20s, like, talk to friends, and they didn't know anything that was happening with their politicians. They had absolutely no knowledge. And growing up in a country with so much turmoil and such political heat, there was an urgency to need to know, because it was extreme. And so it was very difficult when I realized that, oh, wait, I guess when everything is going so good for so long, you don't need to kind of stretch yourself and challenge yourself to actually know what is happening within the political system. And I think that we are now finally at a time where people are realizing, like, oh, okay, we've got to actually, like, educate ourselves about how the system is working. Like, how do you actually get the voters to vote for the people that you think can actually be change makers if the system doesn't allow for that?
Oh, this is what the Attorney General does. Huh.
Yeah, exactly.
I have no idea.
Well, it's like when Jimmy Kimmel does those, like, when he walks up Hollywood Boulevard and they, like, has photos and he's like, who's this? And they're like, I have no idea. And I'm like, come on, you can do it. But I just think that we have to take, and I agree with you, you should never throw the baby out with the bathwater. And there are great people doing great things. And I don't think any of us here tonight said that there's nobody. I think it's just, for me personally, it's a frustration with the value. And I'm repeating myself, so we should probably close this night off. But it's the value of what we put in youth. And I think that we have to change that. I think that there are a few great young leaders, young voices out there, and I am the first to support them, and I agree with you. But how about we have some more? And I think, you know, having conversations like we have here tonight starts the conversation of how we kind of look at our youth and how we value them and how we treat them and what are the tools and the resources that we're really giving them to be the leaders of our country today. And so it's taking the responsibility on our end to kind of support that instead of basically sitting on our couches and bitching about it. And I take that for myself. You know, I'm talking to myself right now. We all, anyway, I'm going to stop.
Listen, Sorry. It's a perfect way to end because it is really mirrors. It is. Because it mirrors what we started with, right? Which is at some point you have to do conversations with young people.
Yeah.
To engage them, to talk to them, and maybe most importantly, to listen to what they have to say.
What they need, yeah.
Charlize Theron, Kwaku Mandela. Nice to have you both. Thank you. Appreciate it.
That was Charlize Theron and Kwaku Mandela on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Today's podcast is presented with support from Loretta and Victor Kaufman, Hansen, Jacobson, Teller, Hoberman, Newman, Warren, Richman, Rush, Collar, and Gelman LLP, Maya Birkenrode and Ty Lopez, and Miranda and Brett Tolman. If you like what you heard, you can check out past episodes, and while you're enjoying more from Geffen Playhouse Unscripted, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or at podcast1.com, and don't forget to rate, review, and share. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Be sure to download new episodes every Wednesday at podcast1.com, on the Podcast One app, or subscribe at Apple Podcasts.